Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Sait. I'm a host of New Books in Ukrainian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm speaking today with Olena Palko and Konstantin Adelianu, editors of Making Ukraine, Negotiating, Contesting, and Drawing the Borders in the 20th Century, published by McGill's University Press in 2022. Olena Palko is currently Leverhulme Early Career Fellow in the Department of History, Classics, and Archaeology at Birkbeck University of London. Starting in August 2022, she will be an assistant professor at the Department of History, University of Basel, working on her new research project, Red Tower of Babel, Soviet Minorities Experiment in Interwar Ukraine, funded by the Swiss National Science Foundation. Her research interests lie in the field of early Soviet cultural history and the interwar history of Eastern Europe. She was awarded her PhD from the University of East Anglia in 2017 and held research fellowships at Free University and Basel University. She's the author of Making Ukraine: Literature and Cultural Politics under Lenin and Stalin. Konstantin Adelianu is the professor of modern Romanian history at the Department of History, Philosophy and Sociology of the Lower Danube University of Galati, where he teaches courses on the 19th century Romanian history and the economic development of the Danubian and Black Sea areas during the 19th and 20th centuries. During the past years, Konstantin has been a long-term fellow of the New Europe College and Institute for Advanced Study in Bucharest, where he coordinates the Pontica Magna Fellowship Program. His books include International Trade and Diplomacy at the Lower Danube, The Sulina Question and the Economic Premises of the Crimea War 1829-1853, and The European Commission of the Danube 1856-1948, An Experiment in International Administration. Hello, Olena and Konstantin. Congratulations on this volume that was just recently published. Well, since our conversation will be about maps and borders, I would like with this question about maps. So what is a map for a historian and who is a cartographer for in the process of history writing, in your opinion?
Konstantin, would you like to start? I think you have more expertise with maps, and then I can talk a little bit more if, you know, as if this applied to Ukraine.
Okay. It's always a relevant question to look at how reality is drawn on maps and what maps mean for history writing and for history making. And our own project also involved map making and looking at maps and looking at what maps teaches us about the making of the Ukrainian nation and about the making of the Ukrainian state. There's a very lengthy historiography related to maps, And in this book that was just published, there's a lot on map makers and the importance of maps. And the book itself includes about 30 maps that were drawn by a Ukrainian cartographer. And it's always a very difficult challenge to make maps of such a diverse region and such a contested region. It's not only about Ukraine, but it's about Eastern Europe. And how do we play with maps and what it means to, for example, put labels on maps. That's a very interesting element. And in fact, in my own research, which is about the border along the lower Danube, I started from maps and from how in the post-Crimean war context in the mid-19th century, maps started to appear, and they were used as instruments in order to draw borders, and they were in fact instruments to create new realities. So as some sort of preliminary conclusion, maps are not objective elements that describe realities, but they are instruments. It really matters who draws a map, and it really matters how maps are used. And in this book, you will see in several chapters discussions about map makers and the role of maps in making modern states.
I would perhaps also add that, indeed, I completely agree with Constantine. It's important to know or to look at those people who draw maps. But in the case of Ukraine, it's also important to look at who sponsors those maps, who sponsors the science and the experts. Because in this book mainly deals with the interwar period, although there are chapters that obviously deal with the post-war period up to 1954 when Crimea became part of Ukraine. But the key part of the book is the interwar period. This is the period when a lot of new nation states appeared, right? And every government was sponsoring cartographic research, ethnographic research, map making, and so on and so on. But when we think about the period of 1917-1921, the crucial period for drawing and agreeing borders in East Central Europe, Ukraine didn't have a state of its own, or at least it didn't have a stable government of its own, right? And then we have this question, so who creates, who sponsors, who conceives the map for the people who don't have agency, right? Who don't have a government, who don't have, who don't have the representation, official representation on the international scale, same as other countries, as Romania, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and so on and so on. And this is why it's so interesting to see how this, it was not only the process of drawing, but also negotiating. And there is this process of hierarchy, who has more agency to define the border, and basically who will be listened to if we think of this international forum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, mm-hmm. And you also mentioned makers of maps, but also would like to follow up on that and ask who were the consumers of those maps? Because, well, today everyone has access to maps. I mean, everyone who wants to have access to maps. But let's say the beginning of the 20th century, or as Constantine mentioned, his research focuses on the 19th century. Who were the consumers of these maps in the 19th century?
If I may reply to this question, there are two sorts of consumers. And if we look at the Ukrainian case, we have those who look at maps with expertise in mind. So, for example, in several chapters in this volume, there are discussions about the role of maps during the Paris Peace Conference after the First World War, when there was a sort of a real battle of maps with all the nations in Eastern Europe bringing their own maps and bringing their own experts and trying to use this sort of maps in order to claim the possession of different territories. Ukraine and the Ukrainian delegates in Paris were among a very large cohort of such people showing maps and claiming based on those maps different territories. But we also show, and in some chapters in this book, we see how nations are created by looking at maps and how important maps published in different journals, in different books, how they contributed to nation making and to giving some sort of territorial expression to the national idea. That was the case for Ukraine. We have the first maps of the Ukrainian nation well before there was a Ukrainian state. And this, of course, we have in several chapters mentions of Stefan Rutnitsky, who is really vital for the making of the Ukrainian state as this sort of giving an image to the nation, this sort of territorial extension of the Ukrainian nation.
Olena, yeah. would you like to make a comment on those consumers of maps during the time period that you specialize in?
Yeah, I was we have two main sort of cartographers or two main maps that reappear in several chapters in the book. One of them is, of course, Stefan Rudnitsky, and Konstantin already spoke about him. But it's interesting that indeed those people were creating maps. There were like two objectives in mind. The first one was to create, so to say, a textbook, right, for the Ukrainian consumer. But at the same time, during the First World War, Stefan Rudnitsky, for instance, he was part of the Austro-Hungary earlier. He was in Lviv. So he was in occupation and so on and so on. So he was preparing maps for an external consumer to explain where Ukraine was, who were those people, what are their territorial claims and imaginations, right? So it's a dual objective. On the one hand, to tell these people who are on this territory that you are one nation, that this is the extent of your territory, and this is how you should sort of imagine yourself. But at the same time, this is the task to explain the international audience, the international observer, that this is the nation and these are the borders, and they should have the right for those borders. Mm-hmm. But if we think about earlier maps, in the introduction especially, we speak of the 1871 map of the Little Russian, I think it was called, of the South Russian vernacular. This was the first map that basically drew the consistent border across two or even three empires of those, like, kind of the language that would later become known as Ukrainian. And this was map of the late 19th century. It was also created for the external consumer, we can say, because this was the agency of those experts. They were they represented the empire, but at the same time, they showed the empire, the imperial authorities, that this is something separate. This is not just one nation, but there is a perhaps like a group of people that have, you know, like they have a different dialect. So they are separate, they are different. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, is important. But I think at this time, it's still the external consumer who was more important than the internal consumer, especially when we speak of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. So since you already touched upon Ukraine, what do Ukraine's borders result from? And as you mentioned, and it's also mentioned in the introduction, that in the 19th century, there was no state as Ukraine. But on the other hand, in cultural and collective memory, the term Ukraine was quite viable. And although this term wasn't used, right, on some official level by the Russian Empire, this term still existed. So there is some sort of tension here. So I would like to have you comment on that, as well as on this term Malorossia, right? In your book, you use the term Little Russia, right? Is this some sort of a convention still to use this term, or maybe we can somehow reconsider, right, this term for cultural purposes or for historical purposes? Just a thought, and maybe just your comment on that.
Well, I think I'll start with this concept of Malorossia, because this was just a this is the concept to show that those people who spoke the so-called Malorussian dialect or vernacular were part of a bigger nation, the Great Russian nation, and they were that consisted of Great Russians, Little Russians or Malorossi, and White Russians. And those were the three components of one Great Russian people. And this is the concept that started to be kind of conceived, but as well popularized also with in the 19th century, right? When the idea was to create this imperial history, imperial narrative, the narrative of unity that all those parts of the empire, they were sort of the core of the empire, and they were inseparable. And this is, I think, what is what we still have this imperial legacy. We can see it, right, when we think about and when we listen to any Russian propagandists, when they say that the language doesn't exist, that you know, like all the pejorative names they use against Ukrainians and their language, and so on and so on. So this is this continuity of imperial legacy of not seeing Ukrainians as a separate nation. But I think Konstantin can speak of this better. But Ukrainians, right? This is not an exception. When we look at the second half of the 19th century, all those people in East Central Russia, in East Central Europe, they were becoming sort of separate people. This is the period of very active process of nation making. This is the period of the rise of nationalism, so on and so on. So we can say that by the early 20th century, Ukrainians, as you say, there was a legacy of Ukraine, of Ukrainian culture. There was Ukrainian literature, right, and so on and so on. So this was not just a concept that appeared in 1991. There was a foundation for it, and it was very similar to those processes in East Central Europe. It's just that it was hindered by the empire, by a much stronger empire than in the case of Romania, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and other countries in Central Europe that basically in 1919 could break away from the empire. Unfortunately, the attempts of Ukraine independence were not successful, right? And Ukraine became part of another unity of the Soviet Union and was not independent in deciding its own course. And this is the problem. But if we compare the stand where Ukrainians were in, say, mid-19th century, I don't think we were that much different from other people in the region.
I would just add to what Olena is saying. It's the making of the Ukrainian nation in the 19th century is very similar to what happens in this entire inter-imperial borderland. It's the same in Romania, in Bulgaria, in Greece, in Czechia, in Slovakia, and so on. It's the same pattern that we see, and Ukraine as a name is used in the 19th century, and it's a very convenient term for the founding fathers of the Ukrainian nation to use this concept as a way of embracing people that lived along a large region. It's the same also for all these nations. They are not very standardized in terms of language, in terms of identity, in terms of culture. And what we see in the 19th century, it's similar for the Ukrainian nation, it's for the Romanian one, it's for the Serbian one, and so on. And it's just natural that such processes start in some imperial capitals, in Vienna, in St. Petersburg, perhaps. It's where the national elites start from, Starting from what you are asking, Ukraine in the 19th century is widely used. It's used, yes. Perhaps it's not always very consistently used, but it's the same for all nations in the region. That I wouldn't say there's anything particular in the case of Ukraine. If I compared its situation with the other nations in the region.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although you say that it's not quite unique, right, for the Ukrainian case, but I believe that Ukraine is some sort of a region that has been dominated for an extensive period of time by Russo-centric narratives. And for this reason, maybe this name Ukraine is not widely used or is somehow distorted in many cases. And I would also say that this translation into English is probably not the best one, little Ukrainians or great Ukrainians. I believe Rory Finian was using or was suggesting a different term, like minor Russia and major Russia, and maybe those terms would somehow offer a different perspective.
Personally, I don't like such names.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that it's important to not identify this Ukrainian nation as with a name that alludes to something Russian, mm-hmm. or because this tends to create identity problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's why, starting from the question before, all these Malo-Russians and so on, these were used in the 19th century, but they were part of the problem in how historians tend to interpret such names.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They are associated to a certain view on some sort of national hierarchies, and I would say that it's just my personal view. So Ukrainian is definitely a better solution.
Yes, when the name, right, when the name or when the translation contains the this component, Ukraine or Ukrainians, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, Olena?
I just wanted to add something to the question, because you started with the question, so who basically where the borders came from, who agreed on those borders, and then we switched to this the discussion of the concept of Ukraine versus Malorussia and so on. But I think this is also what makes the Ukrainian case interesting yet resembling East Central Europe. That this is what we, Konstantin and I, spoke about when the war broke out and we were asked to write some, some blogs about our book. That it's surprising that we are sort of trapped in this Russian narrative. That we need to debunk those myths about the Soviet, the Bolsheviks creating Russia, that, Lenin created Russia, Stalin added, the Western Ukraine, and Khrushchev added Crimea, and so on and so on. And we are basically trapped in this and forced to work within the same paradigm. But if you look at Ukraine in those crucial years, in the interwar period, Ukraine, same as any other countries, was a result of international agreement. It's not only Russia that, or the kind of the government in St. Petersburg or later in Moscow, who agreed on the border, but this is the agreement of the great powers. And it was the same, it's the same process for other states in the region. Yes, fortunately, they had more agency. Ukrainians, unfortunately, didn't have as much agency. But the process of those, the drawing the borders and negotiating the borders was very similar. And I think this is, This is what we forget, and especially now with the start of this fully fledged war on Ukraine, when there is so much Russian propaganda, and we are just forced to work within, kind of trying to engage with the propaganda instead of thinking what makes Ukraine different, not a part of Russia, rather than explaining why we shouldn't think of it as part of Russia. And this is what Konstantin says. If we use this vocabulary, we are trapped. We need to invent a new vocabulary and showing how Ukraine was part of, at the same time, the agreement of the big three, right? How much of it, like of the Ukrainian borders, it was a result of, I don't know, Winston Churchill's thinking and geopolitics, how much it was of, you know, the American and the British agreement and interest and so on and so on. And I think this is what we tend to forget, just focusing on the Russian side. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't the case. And this is, I think, what we need to, with this book, what we need to highlight. Then this is not only about Russia-Ukraine. This is about the Soviet Union and other great powers. Mm-hmm. And this is the same as other countries in the region. And I think this is very beneficial that we have authors from different countries, because they already, they approach this topic of the making, the drawing of Ukrainian borders from very different perspective, right? They don't have this Russo-centric perspective where they try to explain why it was or wasn't Russia. They it's not that they don't care about their Russian counterpart. They do, but they know that there were other actors at play, and they look at those other actors and they bring them into discussion. And I think this is what is important, that with this book we are also trying to break this pro-Russian narrative and bring other actors, other interests, other geopolitical concepts into play and into discussion.
Yeah, just to add that I fully agree that we need to have a different vocabulary because of Russian as a lingua franca in other parts of Europe. People tend to look at Ukrainians, Moldovans, Belarusians, and so on, and to just name them Russians. And that's still a common mistake in Romania, and it's the same probably in other parts of Europe. And we need to stress as powerful as possible that there's a different nation that has a history that goes back beyond the Russian state and the Russian empire and so on. And this narrative has to be made as clear as possible. Mm-hmm. And we hope the book contributes to making very clear that Ukraine as a state is not some sort of gift or some sort of, as Putin was saying, mm-hmm. some sort of mistake of the Bolsheviks and of Lenin and so on. It's a more complex process that resulted in the state of Ukraine, and this is what this book shows, how complicated this process was and how similar it is to the making of other Eastern European states. Mm-hmm. It's about the First World War, the Second World War, the dissolution of the Soviet Empire and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. I believe there was some academic discussion of how we can or we should refer to Ukraine that was under the Russian Empire. But unfortunately, it was a couple of, probably not even years, but decades ago. But unfortunately, that discussion went unnoticed. But hopefully with your book, right, where we pay attention to terminology again, because apparently terminology does matter. I would like to combine two questions in my next question. So in the introduction, it is mentioned that there is some tension between territory and people. And you already brought up Stepan Rudnitsky and his approach to drawing maps and to seeing, right, a nation. And I would like to cite a quote from your book, from the introduction part, when you talk about Rudnitsky's perspective. This reflected how his definition of Ukraine's territorial integrity shifted as he moved beyond mere ethnography to include those regions of, quote, essential political and economic significance, end of quotes, such as Kuban, Crimea, and Bessarabia.
Yes, indeed, it's an interesting transformation with Rudnitsky, but at the same time, this also reflects the changes of the then Ukrainian government in plural, right? How they start to conceive Ukraine, the territory they want to control, and so on and so on. How they at some point incorporated Crimea as well, and how later on, even the early Soviet government, how they laid, Ukrainian Soviet government, how they laid claims on Kuban and Voronezh, in, you know, those areas bordering, like kind of the borderline between Russia and Ukraine. And this is indeed, but I think it's they do still use ethnography, but from the political, they politicize it, they manipulate ethnography, because it's very easy, it's how to explain, it's just how do you interpret numbers, right? It's always there, obviously there are Ukrainians in Kuban, but this is how you present the numbers to say whether it should be part of Ukraine or it shouldn't be a part of Ukraine. And this is how this process of politicizing ethnography, this is the process of the early 1920s and the 19 and perhaps later on as well. It's just that we see how this, it was also the struggle for control, not only on the territory, but of Ukraine itself. Because if we think about the Ukrainian, Soviet Ukrainian government in the early 1920s, they were trying to present themselves as an equal to the government in Russia. So if they have territorial claims, right, it means that it's not necessarily that they want to join those lands, but it means that they control the country and they like the kind of the territory of Ukraine, and they are equal partner with the Russian government in Moscow, who also have their own territorial claims. So it was also this balance, the equality issue that was going on in the early 1920s. And I think this is what also a kind of referring back to our earlier discussion. This is why we are not writing a book about the formation of the Western Soviet border, right? Because we really, with this volume, we highlight the agency of the Ukrainian kind of part, like the Ukrainian government. It's hard to say government because there are different governments in a different time. But if we think about the longest period of time covered in the book, this is the early Soviet Ukraine, the Ukrainian Soviet government really had enough authority to compete with the Russian government in many questions. It was not only the question of Kuban and Voronezh, but also the question of the formation of the Moldovan Autonomous Soviet Republic, which Konstantin can tell you more about. It's like how they realized that this desire of the central government to create, you know, a separate autonomous republic within the borders of Ukraine, how it would diminish their control over the territory. So they opposed it. And you can see in the 1920s, this back and forth, where should Moldovan Autonomous Republic be, how it should be formed, how it should be governed, and so on and so on. So it really highlights the strengths of the Ukrainian lobby at the time, and shifts us away from this perspective that is just a creation by external forces. But perhaps, Konstantin, you want to add something?
Yeah. I wanted to say that there's you combined the two questions, saying that about territory and all these sorts of disputes. And this is always the case when we look at the context of the First World War, and especially the last years of the war and the dissolution of Europe's empires, there's always such contested territorial issues. And what you are also saying about Rudnitsky, it's also a sort of a maturing from a geographer to more like someone having the thoughts of a statesman, looking at not only at ethnography, which is important, but it was very difficult just to draw borders, looking only at ethnography. It's very complicated in all these mixed regions. It's extremely, it's impossible just to only follow an ethnographic line. And he's mentioning of essential political and economic significance, to me at least, shows how he was interested also in the viability of the Ukrainian state. There were many discussions at the time, at the end of the First World War. The Ukrainian government or governments, they had problems. There were different forces they were fighting against. And this is also how Rudnitsky imagines the viability of the state. There are different regions that are essential to making a Ukrainian state viable. And we see that if we look at the territories mentioned or he mentioned, they are viable today. If we look at how important this Black Sea coast is for Ukraine as a state, we understand that his political thought was as mature as his scholarly thought. I would say.
Would you talk a little bit about the structure of the book, maybe in more details about specific essays and articles that you decided to include in order to construct this volume?
Perhaps I would start. So our intention, we conceived this project back in 2019, and our idea was to put together a puzzle that is Ukraine, those all the neighbors, Ukraine and its neighbors, and how all these parts, how all these aspects of borders, how they were basically negotiated, drawn, and came into being. And this was an opportunity, but at the same time a constraint, because it was like we wanted to, on the one hand, obviously we have this objective to be comprehensive, but at the same time, sometimes it was hard to find a scholar who was able to write a chapter on this particular aspect of border, right? Especially it was difficult in the case of Ukrainian Belarusian border. And given having this intention in mind, we couldn't just leave it out, right? So it at some point it was perhaps took a bit longer because we needed really to complete the puzzle, right? To find the author for each chapter. But the book, it's split into three parts. The first part looks at international agreements and treaties that basically resulted in redrawing of Ukraine and of the border of Ukraine. And here we have four essays. The first essay by Borislav Chernov. He looks at the negotiations at the Brest-Litovsk Peace Conference and how it resulted in the redrawing or kind of the agreement on Ukraine's western border during the First World War. Then we have the chapter by Elżbieta Kwiecińska, who looks at the competing claims of Ukraine of the Ukrainian and Polish delegation at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. Next chapter is by Jan Jacek Bruski, who looks at the Treaty of Riga. This is the peace treaty between the Soviet Russia, Soviet Ukraine, and Poland in 1921. And lastly, Damian Markovsky, he looks at the agreement between the big three during the Second World War. And basically his chapter considers territorial agreements and changes from the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact in 1939 to the agreements up to 1952, when there were some border shifts between Poland and Ukraine, already kind of the socialist Poland and Soviet Ukraine. The second part of the book looks at the establishing the borders of between the Soviet republics. And here we start with Dorota Mihaluk's chapter on Belarusian-Ukrainian border. Although this chapter, it looks at the negotiations in 1918. So technically, it was the negotiations between the Ukrainian People's Republic and the Belarusian People's Republic. But Dorota makes a very interesting argument, which never occurred to me before, that Ukrainian-Belarusian border is one of the oldest borders in Europe because it existed unchanged since 1918. Then Stefan Rindlinsbacher, he looks at the contested lines between Russia and Ukraine and how this border was negotiated and changed multiple times during the 1920s. Then we have a separate chapter on the formation of the Ukrainian-Moldovan border during the interwar and wartime years by Alexander Voronvichi. And I already kind of mentioned this, the, was the formation of the Moldovan Autonomous Soviet Republic and then the Moldovan separate Moldovan Republic. And lastly, Austin Sharon looks at the transfer of Crimea in 1954, discussing whether it was, you know, a gift or kind of the practical consideration behind this transfer. And lastly, this is the third section that looks at the formation of the of Ukraine's western border. It comprises three chapters. So the first chapter is by Sergei Hladyshuk, who looked at the formation of the Polish-Ukrainian border in Volhynia in 1918-21. This was also the period when Volhynia changed hands a few times from being a Polish, imperial, Russian imperial province, split later on between Poland and Ukraine. Yaroslav Kovalchuk looks at Transcarpathia and those changes at the end of the Second World War in 1944-45. And Konstantin Ardelean, he looks at the formation of the Romanian, Ukrainian and Moldovan border at, in the Danube region. And I also wanted to mention the conclusion by Tatiana Zhozhenko, a renowned scholar of Ukraine and of Ukrainian Russian border. And her conclusion, this concluding essay, looks at the making and unmaking of the Ukrainian-Russian border since 1991. She finished just after 2014, showing how those events of 2014, they basically, they became the unmaking of what was quite a successful story since 1991. And what we witness today is a further proof of how this unmaking, what it can lead to.
Yeah, if I may add to this 12 chapters in the three parts that Olena mentioned, there's also a foreword by Professor Ulrich Schmidt from the University of St. Gallen. A very interesting read. And also important for us because the University of St. Gallen, the Center for Culture and Governance in Europe, they have been supporting us in having this book. And there's also an introduction by Olena, firstly, and myself a bit on the history before the making of the borders of the Ukrainian state. But I would like to mention a different thing. And like I was reading before this meeting today, I was reading Tatiana's chapter, the last chapter in the book, some sort of conclusions and really ominous, I would say, and I would advise everyone to read this chapter because she makes it very clear how the past 30 years have been a period of a successful story, if we want to look at it from this perspective, but also some sort of announcement that there are problems in there and that Ukraine should behave in order to preserve the integrity of its territory. And it's really interesting to look at what she says in this chapter. And in all chapters, and this is also a very important contribution of this volume, to see how Ukraine as a state is the result of equally great power politics and all these important diplomatic events in Paris, then after the First World War, then after the Second World War. But it's not only about great power politics, and it's the case in the chapters of Yaroslav Kovalchuk, or also Stefan Ringlisbacher, they show that the agency of smaller communities is also important. It's how exactly the border looks like. It was also decided in other places, not only in Paris or in Moscow or in but also in Transcarpathia or in Bessarabia, and that's really interesting to see how borders are the result of processes happening over larger surfaces, not only in some capitals and in some critical junctures, but it's important to also look at all these smaller actors that shaped the border.
Mm-hmm. Well, as my concluding question, I would like to go back to the beginning of our conversation and when we started with this idea about Ukraine in the 19th century as an entity that didn't have its own territory as we tend to think about. But I believe that still today we kind of struggle with the notion of how to talk about Ukraine of the 19th century or of the 18th century, especially if we are not historians, for instance, or we are not geographers. So what would your recommendation be for this conversation about Ukraine of the 19th century, because as we know, after the full-scale Russia's invasion of Ukraine, many specialists are trying to reconsider their approaches to Russia and to Ukraine as well, or to include Ukraine into this conversation in a more engaging way, I would say. But many tend to say, maybe it's quite naive, but still many tend to say, well, Ukraine didn't exist as a state in the 19th century, so how can we talk about Ukraine then if it was part of the Russian Empire? So your recommendation and your suggestion to opinions like this.
I think one should also remember that part of what is today Ukraine was in Austro-Hungary, right? And then in Poland. So if we only limit Ukraine to this Dnieper Ukraine, what is called to this, the part that was part of the Russian Empire, we sort of distort, right, history, because there is an important historical, there are important historical developments which were taking place in Eastern Galicia or in the Bessarabia or in what is now Chernivtsi and so on and so on. It's just important to bring those parts also into discussion, not to forget that Ukraine was not only part of the Russian Empire, but also actually others and mm-hmm. other empires. But it's a good question indeed. But we can just say, and this is what we mentioned earlier, this was a very similar process to a process to other countries and nations in East Central Europe. There was no Romania in the 19th century. There was no Czechoslovakia or Slovakia. There was no Poland. The case of Poland is perhaps the most telling. There was no Poland since the early or the late 18th century or the early 19th century. So what, shall we not speak of Poland at all? It's just the problem is that Ukraine doesn't yet have enough agency and lobby in the scholarly community to explain that what was happening in the past is not exceptional, is nothing unique. So if we can speak of other countries in the region as full members or parts of the European history and narrative, why cannot we speak of Ukraine? And this is something that we as in the scholars of Ukraine, of Ukrainian studies, should work towards. Mm-hmm. But it's very good that Konstantin, who is not a Ukrainian specialist, also joins this conversation.
Yeah, that's a quality, let's say. I also wanted to mention that it's good to always look at some sort of comparative history, mm-hmm. and to see, as Olena was saying, all states in the region, they were created as nation states in the 19th century and in the 20th century. So it's really important to put Ukraine into the geographical context and to see how similar it is to... And I wanted to say that the only book on the history of Ukraine that it's available in Romanian translation is Serhii Plohni, The Gates of Europe. Mm-hmm. That's the only book available for a Romanian reader. And if you read this book, you will see exactly the same narrative as for the history of Romania. Romania was also established in the 19th century, and it got unified after the First World War with parts that were in the Habsburg Empire, in the Ottoman Empire, in the Russian Empire. So it's a similar story, and it's important to have this comparative perspective and to see that there's a delay of some decades between the making of all these nation states in Central and Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. That's the only difference. And they follow from Greece, that was the first country, in the first nation state in South Eastern Europe that was established in early 19th century. And then there's a wave of new nation states emerging and so on. So that's the first thing that I would say. It's important to have comparative perspectives. The second one, and we mentioned this a bit earlier, is to look at terminology. And it's really important. And I said it today, and we all said it today several times. I think it's important to get rid of this, for example, Russian Empire. Because if we keep using this term, Russian Empire, we might show some sort of hierarchy, but it also creates some sort of logic in relation to the territory that the empire, or this Novorossiya project that Russia uses today. It's good to go beyond such. And perhaps there are discussions in Ukrainian studies about this, but the example of the Ottoman Empire or the Habsburg Empire, so going beyond some sort of having in the name this, which is politicized and which is used as some sort of imperial tool, even now, it's important to get rid of such concepts. That's what I think.
I'll just say that there are indeed other ways of naming the empires Romanov Empire.
Yes.
This is the solution to what you're saying.
Yeah, I think the Romanov Empire is a better way of not giving it some sort of ethnic character, which it did not have, and which is used in order to have imperial claims by those who lead Russia today. Mm-hmm. So I would say that it's really important to have some sort of... And one of the contributions of this book is that it brings together scholars from different countries, from different academic traditions, and it's really important. And this has been done in Eastern Europe and in Western Europe also, to look at all these shared histories that we have, Romanian-Ukrainian, Polish-Ukrainian, Belarusian-Ukrainian, and there are all these sorts of disputes that still exist today, but they are solved through discussions and through cooperation also between historians and so on. And I would say this is an important contribution of this book, that it brings together people from many countries, living in other many countries and working for different institutions from Kiev, but also in Russia, in St. Petersburg, or in the US, and so on.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Konstantin. And yes, it's important to remember, as long as we have this opportunity for debates and for discussions, there is some hope for solving some contested issues. But as soon as we don't have those opportunities, well, to somehow even start a conversation about contestations, I think it's very problematic. But I'm really surprised by that detail that you brought up, that there is only one translation of Serhii Plehii's book into Romanian. And I think it's a sign that translators have a lot to do, not only in terms of English translations, but in terms of translations into other languages as well, which is as important as have translations in English. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Elena, and thank you so much, Konstantin, for your work and for your research and for making this book available to audiences. And I believe it really draws attention to Ukraine as an agent, and it gives Ukraine some agency, and also contributes to decolonizing this perspective on Ukraine as something that, well, just wasn't quite important, right, to consider when the borders were drawn or made. Thank you. Thank you for this very insightful conversation today.
Thank you, Natalia, for inviting
me. Thank you. Thank you, Natalia. Have a nice day.
Today, I spoke with Olena Palko and Konstantin Andelianu, editors of Making Ukraine, Negotiating, Contesting, and Drawing the Borders in the 20th Century, published by McGill's University Press in 2022. Thank you for listening to New Books in Ukrainian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.